Good morning, Fairhaven. My name's Jeremy, one of the pastors here. How are we all doing well this morning? Like it's like super Michigan-y out today, right? Like we lose an hour of sleep, we wake up to snow, right? Like I thought snow was supposed to be over, but then apparently later today it's going to jump to above 40. So like it doesn't know what it's doing outside, but I'm glad for buildings and climate control, right? So we get to hang out here. And I'm looking forward to what we get to do here in this space this morning. For those of you that are new, we have dedicated ourselves to spending this entire year walking through the book of Matthew. Because we care less about necessarily the book of Matthew than we do what Matthew is writing about. Because Matthew was one of Jesus' disciples. Matthew spent 3 years following Jesus, and then he wrote a book telling us about the person of Jesus, what Jesus did, what Jesus taught. And so we are spending the entire year diving into studying that. Who is Jesus? And over the last couple months, we've been looking at the longest sermon we have recorded of Jesus. It's called the Sermon on the Mount. And today, Jesus ends that sermon. We started it literally about 2 months ago. I believe it was in January. We've been following it until now when Jesus is going to conclude the sermon. And what's interesting that we're going to find this morning is Jesus is going to give us, in his conclusion, he's going to give us a handful of pictures. And he's going to give us kind of a dialogue, this dialogue that he addresses, which I think some of us might find a little bit difficult that I want to jump into. And so I want to invite you to turn with us to Matthew chapter 7. We will put all of the words on the screen, but if you want to turn there, we will be in Matthew chapter 7. So let's go ahead and jump in. Matthew 7, starting at 13. This is, again, Jesus concluding his Sermon on the Mount. He says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name?' And then I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness.' Everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell and the floods came up and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who builds his house on the sand. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat against that house and it fell and great was the fall of it. And when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes." So Jesus, he lays out a number of kind of images, but you notice these images are very kind of either or, right? It's either this or that. And then in the midst of these, like, either or, there's a wide way and a narrow way. There's a good plant and a bad. There's either or. And then in the middle of it, Jesus has that one kind of dialogue that if we're honest with, many of us may have actually wrestled with words like these exact words or words like these, wondering, what does Jesus actually mean when he says this? When he does the, "And not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Feels like a hard conversation Jesus is having there, right? And if we're honest, I wonder how many of us have wrestled with words like that, wondering, is it possible? Like, could Jesus say that to me? Right? Like, is it possible that, like, I could end up one day before Jesus, because I'll end up one day before Jesus? And is it possible that Jesus could look at me with this blank face saying, I don't know who you are? Like, what is Jesus actually saying? What is he actually doing there? And in order to understand that, I think we need to jump into, again, what Jesus is doing in the larger context of this teaching. I want to take kind of each image that Jesus gives us on its own, and then kind of try to draw these things together to understand what Jesus is saying in this section. And so we start by Jesus saying this. It says, enter by the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. So the first image that Jesus gives us is this kind of wide way and a narrow way. And even before we jump into that, even the idea of this either-or sermon that Jesus is giving, or the either-or conclusion that Jesus is giving, to Jesus' initial audience, this would have made sense that he ends the sermon this way. Because this is the way people ended talks, many people ended. The Greeks would give kind of this either-or contrast. The Romans would give this either-or contrast. And within their Judaism, they would have been thinking of another sermon that they had heard given where it ends with a very either-or contrast. Jesus' first audience, when they are hearing Jesus' sermon, they are remembering somebody else who would have given a similar sermon thousands of years previous in a guy by the name of Moses. See, Moses, all the way back in our fifth book of our Bible, in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses is going to stand before the Israelites. He's already led them out of Egypt. They've crossed the Red Sea. He's led them wandering that 40 years in the desert. And then at the end of the book of, at the end of Deuteronomy, essentially the book of Deuteronomy is a sermon that Moses is giving to the Israelite people. They are at the end of their wandering through the desert. They're about to cross over into the promised land. Moses is not going to be able to go with them. Moses is going to die. But before he does, he essentially has these last words for the people, kind of his last sermon. And so Moses will give them this sermon. We know it as the book of Deuteronomy. And at the end of Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy chapter 30, Moses says this. He says, see, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to him and to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you are not obedient, and if you are drawn away to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day that you will certainly be destroyed. You will not live long in the land you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. So Moses gives this sermon. And at the end, he says, you have two choices. There are two paths you can walk. There are two ways you can live. One will bring life. The other will bring destruction. They're right there before you. You have to choose. And when Jesus gives this sermon, his audience is already thinking back to Moses. If you were with us when we started the Sermon on the Mount about 2 months ago, Greg shared how Matthew is even setting up the very beginning of his gospel. Jesus is starting the Sermon on the Mount in a way that everybody in that first audience would have been thinking back to Moses. Moses in the book of Deuteronomy is going to quote that he's going to quote essentially the Ten Commandments. He's going to share with the Israelite people again the Ten Commandments. Jesus, early in the Sermon on the Mount, is going to say things like, "You've heard that it was said, 'Do not kill.'" Where did they hear that? Moses, from the Ten Commandments, right? Jesus then, through the sermon, is going to be pointing back, especially often, to those first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. We looked a couple times at Jesus pointing back to the book of Numbers. Who is the book of Numbers attributed to? Moses. And then Moses will end this last sermon by saying there are two paths. One that will lead to life, the other that will lead to destruction. And then Jesus ends this sermon that is already pointing back to Moses by saying, there are two paths before you. There are two ways you can choose to live. One will lead to life, the other, destruction. And then Jesus uses a number of images to kind of explain this either or. And Jesus starts with that image we looked at. There's a wide way and there's a narrow way. So the question then is, what is Jesus' audience thinking when they hear Jesus explaining this contrast between a wide way and a narrow way? And I believe one of the things that Jesus' first audience is right away jumping into their minds, one of the contrasts they know in their world, is going to look something like this. First picture. So what do you see? It's a road, right? A big road, small road, wide road, narrow road. It's a wide road, right? I took a picture of it with some groups of people on it. I've walked this road. You can walk this road. It's an incredible road. This is a Greco-Roman city. This is a Roman road. Because Rome, although they didn't kind of invent the road, they kind of perfected the road. Rome started building these roads that were wide. They were using these large chunks of cut stone to build their road. So they're wide, they're really sturdy. Can you actually, down the middle of it, can you kind of see there's some stones right down the middle of it that don't look like the others? They were really technologically advanced. They actually created almost kind of a trough system underneath where the sewer system of the city, so the dirty water of the city would run out of the city under the road. But Rome essentially perfected the road. Why? Well, there's a number of reasons, but I kind of want to highlight two. One of the reasons is because if you can build a road like that, you can increase the amount of trade. Right? It's way easier to trade when you have a road that looks like that. You can move wagons, you can move horses, you can move people on roads that look like that really easily. And second, roads like that allowed Rome to mobilize and move their military a whole lot faster than they could without them. And any guesses where all of the major Roman roads went to? There's a phrase that we still kind of know. All roads lead to Rome. All the roads lead to Rome, because that was literally the point, right? They wanted to increase trade. They wanted to make sure that they could mobilize their military quickly. All roads lead to Rome. It's a really great, wide, there's a lot of people on this road. The destination this road will eventually bring you is Rome. Okay, I want to show you a different road. First, who calls that a road, right? Can you see kind of the path that's kind of cut into the side of the cliff? It's gonna bend around to the left, and then you can kind of see a line halfway up the picture on that far hill. That is called the Jericho Road. That is a road that connects the city of Jericho to the city of Jerusalem. During Jesus' day, during much of the biblical time, a lot of your priests would live in Jericho. And then when it was their time to serve in the temple, they would make their way from Jericho to Jerusalem, traveling on the Jericho Road. Now, why do I think Jesus might be referencing the Jericho Road? Well, partly because he does elsewhere as well. We know a parable Jesus tells of the Good Samaritan, which happens as somebody is traveling down a road, right? We have a priest who walks down this road. What road is Jesus referencing? Jesus is referencing the Jericho Road. So where is this road headed? This road goes straight to Jerusalem. Wide or narrow? Narrow. Easy or hard? Hard. Like, there's a cliff on the side, right? So, like, you're walking the Jericho Road. There are parts that you have to be really intentional because it is not the wide paved road that will lead to Rome. They both might look like a road. One's wide and easy. The other is narrow and hard. They're both roads. But where they will bring you could not be more different. The wide Rome will bring you to Rome. The narrow will bring you to Jerusalem. Jesus says there's a wide way and a narrow. The wide will lead to destruction. The narrow will lead to life. Jesus continues. Next verse. He says, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them from their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits." So the first image is this wide way and a narrow way. Jesus' second image is about a tree or a bush or a plant that produces good fruit or that produces bad fruit. And he talks about how you will know the difference because of their fruit. Now, I think we understand this imagery, especially as people who live in Michigan. We might understand this a little bit differently, but I think similarly. Is there a picture back there of the tree? If you're going to drive home today, it's okay if it's not in there. But if you are going to drive home today, besides your evergreen trees, what do all your trees look like? They kind of look the same, right? You drive home, besides your evergreens, all of the trees out in our community are essentially bare. And I get it. There's probably a non-evergreen that's not just a bare tree. But for the most part, on the way home, all of your trees are bare. How do you tell then if a tree is healthy or a tree is dead? Right now. Unless you're like really into trees, like it's probably hard, right? How do you know? Well, in a couple months, hopefully sooner than later, the temperature will warm up and the good trees will start to produce buds. They will start to produce leaves. They'll produce flowers. And the bad ones won't, right? We have a tree in our backyard that at the end of summer, it started to like, this tree does not look great, right? Like something's going on with the tree. And then winter hit and all of the trees lost their leaves. This one started to do it in a way that looked odd early on. And so my guess is in a month or two, when the other trees start to come back alive, that one's not in the same way, which means I'm going to have to do what to that one? Cut it down, right? I actually already called my dad and was like, "Hey, I think I'm going to have to borrow the chainsaw in the spring," which led my dad to ask the question, like, "When's the last time you've used a chainsaw?" Right? And my response to my dad was, "YouTube, right? Like, I'll figure it out. My dad's going to help me cut a tree down in the spring, probably. But by your fruit, you will recognize them, right? Right now, the good tree and the bad tree look exactly the same. Once they start to bear fruit or not, the difference is going to mean everything. It either stays or I cut it down." So Jesus starts with a wide way and a narrow way. He jumps into a good and bad fruit. And then Jesus launches into that dialogue that we started with, right? That not everyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. So what is Jesus saying? Well, I think some of the answer is embedded actually in this conversation and in the larger Sermon on the Mount. Because did you notice the one line that I skipped when we went into the good and bad fruit? There's one line right at the beginning where Jesus transitions from the wide and narrow way to good and bad fruit where he says this. In the next line, he says, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. Okay, so beware of a sheep, a wolf that is wearing sheep's clothing. What is Jesus saying? Well, if you think about it, a wolf that is wearing sheep's clothing is essentially one thing on the inside that is presenting like something completely different, right? Jesus has actually just ended a rant that he's gone on where Jesus will often be talking about the hypocrites. And if you were with us a couple few weeks ago, Greg defined that word hypocrite for us. Remember, we think of a hypocrite as somebody who says something but does something different. In Jesus' world, the word hypocrite was an incredibly common word. Anybody remember what hypocrite means? It's essentially a hypocrite in the Greek just means an actor. It means actor. Like we actually translate the Greek word is basically hypocrite. I almost wonder if we should retranslate the word because hypocrite in our world means something different. But an actual hypocrite means an actor. So think of your favorite, who's some of your favorite actors or actresses? Somebody just said a word. I have no idea. So think of your favorite actor or actress, okay? Essentially, we call them actors or actresses. In Greek, that's a hypocrite. That's a hypocrite. That's what the word means. It's an actor. So what does that mean? Well, a hypocrite then, an actor, is somebody who presents something on the outside, but is something different on the inside, right? They present to be one thing, but actually they are somebody else. They aren't the character you see in the movie or the TV show. They're actually something different. A wolf wearing sheep's clothing, you could argue, is essentially an actor. Right? It's something which is claiming and acting like something else, but inside is not what it's looking like on the outside. And so Jesus is saying, beware of those among you. Beware of the hypocrites. Beware of those who present one way on the outside. They pretend to be something, but on the inside, they are very, very different. Beware of those religious leaders among you who are, they are saying one thing, they're presenting one way, but actually they're trying to use and manipulate for their own good. And so Jesus is saying to these hypocrites, those that are pretending to be something they're not or someone they're not, when they come before him and say, Lord, Lord, and Jesus will say, no, you were acting. I didn't actually know who you were. So Jesus does this piece on a wide way and a narrow way. He does a piece on good fruit and bad fruit. And then Jesus will end with probably the most familiar of these images. He says this. He says, everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them, will be like the foolish man who builds his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. So there's a wise builder who builds on the rock. There's a foolish builder who builds on the sand. And now I grew up hearing kind of this story, this contrast between the rock and the sand. And the way I'd always heard it was essentially Jesus talking about foundations, or he's talking about building material, right? that you build on the rock because the rock is sturdy. It's not shifting sand. But then I do not claim to be a builder as much as I don't claim to be like a chainsaw expert, right? But you builders, what do we do when we build a house? Do you bring in truckloads of rock? We bring in sand, don't we? So like, are we the foolish builder, Jesus? What's going on? And although there's something about sand and rock, especially in their day for building, I want to make the case that Jesus is using an image that his audience would have known well. Let's look at the next picture. This is a wadi. So a wadi is essentially a dried up riverbed. In areas of the Judean wilderness, like where this picture is taken, there are places where it'll rain 2 inches a year, a small handful of inches every year, and then it won't rain in the dry season for that 8 to 9 months. If it doesn't rain for 8 to 9 months, what does the ground look like? It's dry. It's hard. It's hard to tell in here, but that kind of darker color outside of the bottom of the wadi, that might look like dirt. It's rock. Okay, so that is all rock. Can you tell that on the bottom of the wadi, it's a lighter color? Sand, right? When it does rain, the sediment will come down from the rock. It'll collect in the bottom, in the wadi bed. That's where you're going to find your sand. So the difference between your sand and your rock is not significantly great, right? And what in that picture looks flatter? The sand, right? Like, it almost looks easier. But the thing about a wadi is when it does rain, something really interesting happens. When it rains, because the ground is so hard, because it doesn't rain, because the ground is so prevalently rock, when it rains, it could rain miles uphill, and that water that falls does not absorb into the rock. It doesn't absorb into the hard ground. Instead, it starts to collect. And then it starts moving downhill really, really quickly. And so you might not even know it's raining, but it might have rained miles uphill from where you are in the wadi. And I want to show you, I don't believe we have a picture before, but I want to show you what happens. Let's go to the next slide. So notice there's a little bit of water in that wadi. There's not much, but there's a little. But look what's coming. And do you see rain in the video? I'm going to trust nobody knows modern Hebrew because I have no idea what that guy just said. All right, can you bring me back to that original wadi picture? Back to the picture before the video. So what happens to anything you built on the sand? It's gone, right? It's absolutely gone. That water is going to come through like a freight train. There's no rain in the picture, but it's raining somewhere else. And that water has been collecting and moving. By the time it gets to where you're at, it's like a freight train coming through. Nothing stays. But the difference you notice in the video between the sand and the rock, how far was it? Not far, right? It's a handful of feet. And the difference is everything. So Jesus, he talks about a narrow way and a wide way. The wide way might look easier, but they both look like roads. But the destination means everything. There's a tree that bears good fruit and a tree that bears bad fruit. Initially, before they bear fruit, they might look exactly the same, but whether or not they bear fruit means everything. There's rock and there's sand. They might look like they're really close. They're only a matter of feet away from each other, but the location means absolutely everything. Jesus says there are two ways. There are two ways that you can live. There are two choices you can make. One will bring life. The other will bring destruction. So what does that way of life look like? Well, I want to look back again to that sermon that Moses gives at the end of Deuteronomy, that sermon Jesus is pointing at. Did you notice Moses kind of lays out three things that define that way that brings life? He says this, "Yes, set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in obedience with him and to keep his commands, decrees and laws. Then you will live and increase and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess." In this section, I want to pull out three things. Love the Lord your God. Walk in obedience to him. Keep his commands. Moses says this is the way that will bring life. Jesus, through the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus will identify that first one as being the greatest commandment, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, with everything you are. To walk in obedience. Remember, Jesus, right before his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is baptized as a way of saying, I am committing to walking the right path. I am committing to walking the way that God calls us and to invite you to follow. And then, by keeping God's commands, by Jesus went into that piece about fulfilling or abolishing and saying, don't do away with the commands of God, but live into them. Because this is what it looks like to live out of that relationship with God. It's all about relationship. It's not from the bottom up where we're trying to do a bunch of things to convince God to like us. But Jesus is inviting us into relationship with himself, saying now, because we are in relationship, it calls you to live a certain way. It reminds me of, I'll close with a quick story. It reminds me of a story, a guy by the name of Jonathan. I read it this week. Jonathan was processing a recent diagnosis he had just received. He was diagnosed with a terminal cancer. And Jonathan, in this article, he was processing through some of his diagnosis, but most of what he was processing through was what it meant for his son, who will turn 2 at the end of this month. And so Jonathan knows that he doesn't know how much time he's got left. It might be months, it might be years, he's not sure. But Jonathan, as he's processing through what his diagnosis means to him, he couldn't help but think to when he was 6 years old and his own dad was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And he said early on, a bunch of his dad's friends would come around and help. But then the days turned into months, which turned into years. And this disease stole a lot right off the bat. And then it just kind of prolonged. Jonathan and his immediate family would spend the next 15 years caring for dad until his dad passed away when Jonathan was 21 years old. And he said one of the most striking things he can remember is that after his dad had passed away, a bunch of people had come to the visitation and they were at the funeral and they came and introduced themselves and said, hey, we're friends, like we're friends with your dad, or we worked with your dad, or we whatever. And Jonathan said he just couldn't shake this feeling that as he's seeing all these people, he's realizing, I don't know any of you. Like, I might have heard your names, I might have heard some stories, but I don't know who you are. You weren't there. And so Jonathan's processing now. He's now a dad with an almost 2-year-old son, wondering, with what time I have left, who's going to care for my wife and my son? And so Jonathan shared in the article about how one of the things he's been asking his friends is, will you be there? Will you care for my family? And he shared with his friends that he's asked them. He said, when we meet again in heaven one day, I want to ask you, did my son know you? Did my son know you? Like, actually know you? It feels as though Jesus ends this Sermon on the Mount. It feels as though the question that God is inviting us into is, it's almost as if God is asking us, like, does my son know you? Does he actually know you? Does he know about you? Do you know about him? Or does he actually know you? Because the invitation is to step into that relationship. Loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Walking in obedience, keeping those commands. Does my son know you? So today, if you're in a space where you look at your life and it feels like you've just been acting, you've been going through the motions. Maybe you've wondered about Jesus, but you've never really stepped into that relationship. I want to invite you to even start that journey today. Or if you're in a space where it feels like you're acting, it feels like you're going through the motions, it feels like you're acting, to take a next step. There's actually, this Sunday's a Next Step Sunday. There are Next Steps cards in the back of the pew right in front of you. I'd even invite you, grab one of those cards, think over it, pray over it, and if you sense God inviting you to take a next step, fill that out, give that to Greg, Lori, myself, hand it off to Alyssa. We would love to walk along with you on that journey. But would you pray with me? God, as we sit here this morning, God, we recognize that you are constantly calling us into those next steps. For some, the first step. For others, another step in a long line of steps. But we know that our steps matter because our steps are about destination. That the way we're moving matters. And so, God, we just pray that you would help us to take those next steps in the direction of Jesus. That we would welcome the invitation that he has so freely offered to be in relationship with you through him in your spirit. God, it's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.